Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, please go to pnwa.org. So I spent a good part of today reading through the 89 poems that comprise today's guest John Fitzgerald's collection of poems, The Mind, which was published in 2011 by Salmon Poetry. And as I read through poem after poem after poem, I began to get the feeling that John, this fellow I've never met before, had crawled into my mind and had reported back in verse on what he found there. Now, of course, I know that's not true, but I have to say that for me, the arts and poetry in general, that when the artist goes, I think, very deeply into an intimate experience of their own life, they often find something that sounds a lot like everyone else's life. That's certainly true for me. It's what I found to be the case. But let's find out if that's so for John. John, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
John, The Mind, this is an interesting collection. I don't think I've read a collection quite like this, in that it's comprised of, as I said, 89, did I get the number right? I did, 89, yes. Nine-line poems that are grouped thematically around everything from truth and beauty to fear and death, and the I. Did this collection evolve specifically around that idea, or did you just begin writing poems and discover that there was a sort of theme evolving?
Well, I had in mind when I began to write about the main parts that are the groups, like the truth and beauty, just aspects, mental aspects, like fear and beauty and truth and things that only exist in the mind. And so that was my goal when I started. But originally, I just wrote the first 10 parts, and I kind of stopped for a while, but I couldn't really get that certain beat that it had out of my mind. So I just kept it up and kept it up, and it took around 9 months to write them all.
When you say the first 10 parts, did you mean the first 10 poems?
Parts one
or
through
just,
10.
Oh,
the,
right.
The
actually, just parts
the
one.
First 90 lines, basically.
Right. I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you see it as one large poem?
I see it as one large poem, yeah. It's one continuous thing with 89 parts. Each one is in three groups of three lines.
Yeah. It's a very meditative experience to read them, I have to say. You kind of just descend into that voice. I quite enjoyed it. And I love that it is the mind, because to me that is our non-physical experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the part of us that's the part that our creative selves, it seems to me, is in constant relationship with.
Yeah, I think so too. Really, that's what makes us human, actually. We just seem to have this constant flow of thinking going through our heads at all times. And for me, it's not good enough to just think the things. I feel compelled to write them, so I'm not really satisfied with just thinking things. So.
And, of course, you're not simply writing the things you've thought. The poems reflect upon the experience of thinking,
yeah.
And then there's what that actually means to think those things.
Yeah, exactly. It really is just the way I think. So it's
yeah.
I'm just, you know, like I say, I'm just not satisfied with only thinking it, and I just write it down.
Now, each of these parts, as you said, are comprised of three stanzas, each that has three lines. So it's short, but do you, and it did feel this way to me as I was reading them, but did you go into each part seeking discovery? Like, where did it begin, and how, and were you aware of searching for discovery as you went in to each new part?
Well, yeah, I was with each, after I finished the first 90 lines, the first 10 parts, so with each new one, my goal was just to see if I could write 9 more lines. So I wanted mm-hmm. them to each be self-contained, and as you can see from the book, there's only 9 lines on every page of the book.
Right.
So each one I wanted to kind of be self-contained, and then in the group of them, I wanted that to be contained as well, and then in the book as a whole, it's the largest container of the thoughts there.
Yeah.
But I did have in mind, like, I was just, my goal was, let's see if I can just write 9 more good lines that stand on their own.
Yeah. Well, yes, who was it? I can't remember the poet that the artist poem is always your next one, kind of.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's one of the lines in the mind is what a huge fear the last poem always is. And that's how I felt for a long time. Like, now I wrote this poem, I'll probably never write another one. You know,
Isn't that strange? But we all go through. But it must be, because in order to write, you have to, you always approach that blank page, which is always the unknown. Even though, I mean, it's always unknown. You begin with the void in a way, don't you?
Yeah, actually, I write everything on legal pads. And mm-hmm. I just have, you know, about on my desk right now about probably 100 legal pads, and each one is in various filled to various capacities. You know, some are all the way full, some, you know, just. But I write every night. I just write basically what I'm thinking. And
what you're thinking.
Yeah, just what I'm thinking, and sometimes I just get lucky. It turns out to be good enough for other people to read.
Right. And so when did your writing journey begin? Was this something that you had always been interested in, even as a boy, or did it come around later in life?
Yeah, I it's always since childhood. My father, he was always telling me he was going to write a book, but he never did get around to it. He died young.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's kind of just been seems to be, even in school when I was a kid, like I was already, like when my friends, like in high school, when my friends took shop classes, I took other English and writing classes.
Right.
Just the way I've always been. And my first published poem was in 1991, and that was in a journal that's now defunct that used to be put out by UCLA.
Uh-huh. And how was that experience, seeing it actually in print? Did that mean anything to you?
Yeah, it was great. Then, you know, there were readings associated with it too, and I liked it.
You know, the experience of reading your poetry aloud and having your poetry read by others, it can be unique in that there's what you went through writing it, and then there's what the audience goes through hearing it or reading it themselves. Have you had a chance to talk to some of your readers about what they've gone through reading your work?
A little bit. I go around doing readings, and, you know, after they're over, people come up and talk to you a bit, and in fact, that's the way I met Helene. After I did a reading out of that, well, it wasn't the book yet. It was before the poems were when it was just pre-publication. I was still reading the poems. I've been reading these poems for years to people. Like, just because it came out in 2011, the poems themselves have been around a while. But for example, I have a new book coming out from Salmon Poetry next year, in I think in February, so in 8 or so months. And those poems have been around a while, too. So it takes me a long time to actually get a book to, I think, be good enough for others to read.
It takes you a while to feel like you've collected enough poems that could comprise that you feel is worthy of a book. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's not like that. It's not like I'm just writing random poems and then putting them together in a book. I really have the book in mind. Like I have a theme and a book in mind, and I'm trying to, fulfill that.
And so So writing has always been of interest to you. Was it always poetry, or did you have novels or plays in mind, or really was it just poetry?
Originally, it was poetry, and when I wrote the book Spring Water, that's basically a novel in verse, so that it's kind of a novel, but it's broken into verse, so... and then I wrote an actual novel called Primate that I still have to get around to sending it out for publication. But that novel's done. And now I'm writing nonfiction. And I always have poetry in the back of my mind.
And what is it about poetry that draws you to it? Because poetry was probably one of my first real ins to my deepest understanding of writing. Even though I wrote stories as a young boy, poetry became my in. What is it about it that draws you to it and keeps you there?
Well, one thing is that you can kind of feel a sense that you've actually finished and accomplished something more quickly.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. No, I know what you mean.
Yeah. And the other thing is because when you write fiction, you're just making things up, right? And when you write nonfiction, you're just telling the truth, basically, as best you can. Everything is, I guess, on a continuum between the truth and a lie. But when you're writing poetry, you can actually just you're, I think, ultimately talking about yourself. And in that way, the way I look at it is, I'm just recording my thinking process, kind of, and my voice, and my poems are intended to be read aloud. They're intended to be read slowly, with no syllable thrown out. Every syllable is accounted for, and they're meant to basically mimic my voice pattern and my way of thinking. At the times when I'm lucid and thinking clearly, like right now, I seem to be, stuttering a lot. But in the poems, all that stuff's removed. So when I read them, it's just like hearing my thinking without all this stuff.
For me, I always think of my writing as going to my best place, and that's where I try to write from. And to me, that's why it's so special, because I understand within the environment of the desk how to go there. I can't always go there out and about in the world. In fact, I frequently don't. But for me, I feel like I can get there with the paper and the computer or whatever I use. Do you have that experience as well?
Yeah, I think so. It's when I'm sitting here in my office, like, you know, surrounded by books and my typewriter, my keyboard. I don't have a typewriter. I have a computer. while I'm here at night, it's just what I feel compelled to do. I just really all I do is read and research and write, and that's pretty much how I spend my time at work and my time at night when I get home.
Yeah, and your work by day, you're a mild-mannered lawyer, and then at night you don your poet's cape and do that. But do you find that the work of being a lawyer, is the lawyer so totally separate from the poet, or is there any? Because I've interviewed, you know, I could have an entire magazine devoted just to lawyers who write books, also, because there's so many. And I mean, ones who are doing it professionally, but usually they write fiction. Often they write, you know, legal thrillers, whatever, but some write literary fiction. I mean, there's some variety, but they often write fiction. You're the first poet lawyer I've talked to. And I understand the connection between the storyteller and the lawyer. That's a very easy. But do the poet and the lawyer mix at all?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I've actually been asked that often. And like in my upcoming book, my upcoming book actually has a poem, a long poem, another long poem, or a sequence of poems. I think it's around 480 lines. And, well, I can say it's exactly 489, but it basically addresses that connection. I can't really say for sure if it's a poet and his inner lawyer or a lawyer and his inner poet, you know, it's hard to say which is actually which, but, I think they do, they're not. You know, it's not like I'm two different people. So, obviously, both things combine in a certain way.
Now, you mentioned Helene, who's I interviewed about a month ago, Helene Cardona, who's an actress but a poet as well. And so, you guys, do you, since you both write poetry, do you let yourselves read each other's work and talk about it, or is that not on the table?
Oh yeah, she's read all my work and I've read all hers. And
Do you give feedback or does that not happen?
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, we give feedback to each other. Yeah. Yeah. We try to make the poems better that way.
That's great. You know, I'm, my wife's a writer as well, and I wouldn't know how to be married to someone who isn't a writer, just because she knows what I go through. You know, if I come in, like I came today and was in a foul mood because of how it went this morning, and she knew what that was, and we could talk about it, and kind of, you know, she kind of talked me down. But so I find it incredibly useful to be married to another artist, another writer. Do you find that to be the case at all, or does that?
Absolutely. I find it really. Like you say, it's almost indispensable. Like you can't really have a partner who doesn't understand this, who doesn't. In other words, she has to have her time to write and do things as well. So
You know, one of the nice things about being in a close relationship with another artistic person is, and I've talked to other writers about this, is that writers, when they start talking about the writing process, can start sounding a little mystical, because you're often talking about, I always think of it as a relationship with my imagination, with my thinking, with that which provides me the ideas for things. And it's very easy when talking about this to people who don't deal with their creative life on a conscious level every day to start sounding just a little bit weird, maybe, to these folks. But it's nice to have someone you can talk in this language to, with them know what that means, to be in relationship with this creative self.
Yeah, it is. Well, yeah, it kind of sometimes does seem when I'm writing that, first of all, I'm surprised at what comes out. I think, where did that come from? You know, like, and the other thing is just thinking itself is sort of, you know, it's inexplicable. It is mystical. It's really like, you know, before there's language, before there's a time in human history or in human evolution where there's no language yet.
And at that,
you have to ask yourself, well, you don't have to, but it's interesting to ask yourself, what goes on in the mind of a person before there's language? When you picture, say, a hunter, and see you're with a stick, you sharpened yourself, and you're out hunting for something, and you don't have any words to speak with, but you're a hunter, so you're noticing things, you're observing, you're tracking. You don't just stand there with your sharp stick and hope something comes and impales itself. You have to go out and track something, and going on in your mind is this deductive type of reasoning. Like you see, like, you know, a lion or something following, or a hunter before language following, say, an antelope, is going to know what he's, even before, he hasn't seen it yet. It's gone. It's not in his sight. But he knows it came through here, it scraped right there, stepped right here, went over there. All that is going on in its thinking. And it's basically as if Earth spoke to you, and
that's right,
in your head. Earth is speaking to you inside yourself, and it's telling you all this information. And if you give those things words, then that process becomes the mind. It becomes thinking. And when that happens, I think it's kind of a mystical thing.
It is. God, that is such a great analogy, John. I love that. And it reminds me of something I've thought about with language, which is, it's hard to remember, but to me, information comes before expression. So in other words, it first comes the felt knowledge, and then I find the language to express it. But the information comes prior to it taking form.
For sure.
So it comes pre-verbal. I mean, it can happen so quickly that it seems to come verbally, but in truth it doesn't, I don't think. Not the real stuff.
No, I think not at all. I think for sure there's the information comes before the vocalization of it. It comes before, the word comes after the thought.
Yes. Yes, and I have learned, for me, that when I'm trying to learn how to say something, quote unquote, that my best thing to do is to remove thoughts of language and simply try to see or feel the thing I'm trying to express clearly, and then let the language come.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Instead of getting all caught up in the thesaurus mode of just throwing words out that might sound like it.
Yeah, I find it more facilitating to the process to just start writing whatever, you know. I don't try to think, okay, I'm going to sit and write a poem. I just start writing, and then whatever comes, I'll give a label to it. But at the beginning, I'm just wanting to just write, basically, just to get things on the page,
Do you do a lot of editing? Because not all, I've wrote some poems where I did no editing and I loved them, you know, and they came out just fine the first time around. Sometimes I edit them. Do you do a lot of it, or does it come out pretty good the first shot?
No, I do a lot of editing. Everything I've written is probably 50 versions of it. I write a whole bunch of versions of everything, and then sitting on my desk right now is about 20 pages of the same poem over and over and over with tiny little changes in them.
Really? So you write it again and again and again?
I don't write the whole thing over. It's on a word processor, so I can make little changes here and there. And then I'll try them that way, because, you know, I'm not afraid to change it. It's not like it's not sacred. But, I'm pretty much... Until a book comes out, I'll change a poem every time I read it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, pretty much. Like I can almost, and then later on I'll change it back again. Like it's like, but I'm not afraid to try it a new way.
So when you go do the reading, do you ever do the reading and then in the middle of the reading switch it up just as you're doing it? In other words, you've got the thing in front of you and you're reading along and you come to line two and you change what line two in the moment. Does it ever happen spontaneously?
You mean as I'm reading to other people?
Yeah, as you're audience? Doing a live reading.
No,
yeah.
when I do the live reading, by that time, it's exactly what's on the page.
Okay, you don't want to mess around there. You don't want to improvise.
No, I don't improvise. I've by the time I read a poem aloud to someone, I've read it to myself probably thousands of times.
Really?
I've recited it out loud to myself thousands of times. I can pretty much, I don't really have to read my poems to people, but I still hold the book there as some kind of shield or protection from the people. But I don't really need to read them. I can just say them if I want, but that's just because I've read them so many times.
Yeah, and you read them aloud to yourself.
Aloud to myself.
That's how you know them. That's how you learn if they're working or not.
Yeah, I read every poem that's published of mine aloud to myself thousands of times.
God, thousands of times? How can you hear
thousands
it? My thing is I would just not be able to hear it anymore. You know, it'd become like a part of the wall that I'm just, like a stain on the wall that I'm just used to seeing. I would forget that it was a stain. You can hear it fresh?
Yeah, I read it out loud. I go, like for my new book, hardly anyone has heard any of the poems from them yet. Uh-huh. But I've read a couple. I've read a couple. In fact, even I've read some in an interview like this. A couple of them that are coming up. And I've read all those poems out loud to myself thousands of times, and it's, you know, there does come a time when you think, okay, I need a little break from this. But
I would think that would have to be after a dozen times, but you can do it a thousand times.
Yeah, I do it over and over and over and over, and to the point where I make sure that there's no syllable that I ever stumble on. If that happens, I think I need to change it. And if I accidentally say something when I'm reading it to myself, if I say accidentally a different word, I have to wonder whether that's the word that really belongs there or not. And I go back and think, oh, okay, well, since I say that, let's see if that's what it really is. And so,
interesting.
And like I say, I'm not afraid to change things. But once they're out in book form, then that's that. I feel just leave it alone now. But up to then, I'm willing to change it every single time I read it.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what, John, that's a talent right there, being able to read it honestly and clearly to yourself over and over again and not become lost in it,
in my opinion.
Well, John, thank you so much. This has been just a treat. What's the next book going to be called?
It's called Favorite Bedtime Stories.
Favorite Bedtime Stories. It's going to be out. Yeah. When is it coming out?
In early 2014.
Okay, early 2014. In the meantime, everybody can go pick up a copy of The Mind by John Fitzgerald. John, thanks again. This has been just wonderful.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And for all of you, next Tuesday, I will be talking to journalist and debut novelist Sonora Jha. Until then, try to write a poem. Just sit down and write and see what happens. If you like poetry, if not, write what you love, talk to who you love, about what you love. Oh, music. And you can't go wrong. Bye-bye now.